Moore.
Here.
Debbie Berry.
Here.
Bruce Rinker.
Here.
Three members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Pledge allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. The minutes of the previous meeting.
Approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Very good. We'll have the financial report.
Great, thank you. Good morning, commissioners.
Morning.
David, thank you. These represent numbers through August 31st, so it largely covers our busy season as we now approach the shoulder season. Jumping right into the property taxes, this is reflective of how crazy last year was. There was a split payment in August of last year that we received between August and September. We got it all this year, so that difference that you see up there of the $15 million is actually timing. We will be largely on track. We'll be much closer. We'll be within about $3 million by the end of September, if not closer. And then by the end of November, we should be trued up with where we were in 2020. We're actually about 1.6 million behind where we were in 2019. So it just shows the volatility of the timing, but that's all it is. Gross amount will end up exactly where you expect it come the end of the year. Looking at the charges for services, we're about 7.7 million better than we were in 2020. The zoo is the major contributor to that due to the shutdown last year, then enterprise, then golf. However, when we look at 2019, we're about $550,000 less than 2019. So fairly comparable overall, but that's inclusive of enterprise being down from 2019, about 2.3 million or 42%, which we'll see when we look later at our operations. And so from a total revenue perspective, we're about $33 million more than we were last year. Again, much of this is the timing difference from the tax piece, and we're about $10.2 million greater than 2019, largely due to restricted monies for specific use, grants and other.
Bill, the local government grants and gifts, that's a big jump. What's that largely represented?
Timing of when we receive grants and donations.
Oh, okay.
For cash basis, it's just a matter of when we actually get them in the bank.
Okay.
But again, those are mostly restricted monies. They're tied to specific use.
Yeah.
So what we'll see is corresponding spend, usually on the capital side, that relates to a lot of those as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Because they're specific projects. But it has been, a development team has done a great job this year. They continue to work hard and they're pulling in some nice funding for us. When we look at the total operational expense, we're about $3.8 million more than we were in 2020, about $7 million less than we were in 2019, mostly driven by payroll. That makes up about $5 million of that difference. So when we come down to the operating surplus, about $29 million more than 2020. Again, you can see $17 million of that occurred just in the month of August alone, majority of which is the timing of those taxes, as we referred to earlier. And then we're about $17 million better than we were in 2019. This is driven by the restricted revenue that you just mentioned, Commissioner Moore, and about $7 million less of operational expenditures. From a CapEx perspective, we've spent about $2.9 million more than last year. We spent about $7.6 million more than we did in 2019, investing throughout the Park District. So from a net surplus perspective, this puts us at about $26.3 million better position than last year, about $10 million better than 2019. But again, when you look at some of the volatility and timing, that $10 million is driven by restricted funds, the timing of those, and therefore specific use. Moving to the zoo, we're about $5.3 million ahead of 2020, but we're about $392,000 ahead of 2019. So we're actually very comparable in terms of revenue to 2019. Our operating expenses are about $550,000, $551,000 more than 2020, but we're about $1.9 million behind 2019. Again, a significant portion of that is related to payroll costs. The operating subsidy is about $4.7 million less than 2020, in other words, favorable. When we look at 2019, we're about $2.3 million less than we were in 2019, which is very similar to where we were at the end of July when we looked at these numbers. Capital expenditures, about $2.4 million less than 2020, about $1.6 million less than 2019. And this translates down to a net subsidy position of about $2.1 million, which is $7.1 million better than 2020, about $3.9 million better than 2019. And then just a quick highlight, the question came up before the meeting today about what happens with zip line expenditures, since we're putting the restricted fund revenue through, or the revenue through the restricted fund. Other than the build of the zip line, which we did put through the restricted funds, we don't have additional operating expenditures to speak of for the zip line. We've not added any staff. We're not incurring any additional cost driving this. So it is high margin revenue to the organization. If we do need to put any monies back into the zip line, we would follow that through the restricted fund as well, and it would net against this revenue.
What does it look like the payback is going to be on the zip line?
What payback is going to be?
Yeah, what does it just look like?
2 years.
2 years, okay.
Maybe slightly less, but generally speaking, about 2 years.
Good.
From a golf perspective, I didn't mean to rush. Was that okay? Are we okay on the zoo?
Yeah, that's fine.
From a golf perspective, rounds are up about 6% this year. Revenue is up about 13%, so that's about $780,000 greater than 2020. This came down from about $139,000 from last month. The weather is having some impact, but we are seeing us even out a little bit with the 2020 season as we go into the shoulder months. From an operating expense standpoint, we are $553,000 more than 2020, again, supporting the higher revenue, so this makes sense. We really cut back last year for obvious reasons, and now we're spending some more resources taking care of the courses. This puts our operating surplus at about $227,000 better than it was in 2020. This is down about $194,000 from last month. So again, we start to see this evening out a little bit with where we were in 2020. Worth mentioning, 2020 was a banner year, so that's not a bad thing. Looking at the net surplus position, we're about $63,000 behind last year after the capital expenditures, but we've now completed our CART buyout that we deferred in 2020. So the 5-year plan that we had executed, I think 6 years ago or 5 years ago now, we tried to accelerate last year. We weren't able to do that. We deferred it into this year. We wrapped it up. So we're in a good position on our CARTs.
So right now you've consolidated the fact that your cash flow ahead 1.9 from where it was 5 years ago, we were sort of behind that much almost. So that's really an accomplishment.
It's significant. And we can pull together the history to show, in fact, we should pull together the history to show how golf has progressed, certainly over this levy cycle, because it's really had a nice trajectory. The performance has been steadily improving all across the last 7 or 8 years, if not longer than that, prior to the levy cycle. But it's been really operating well. We've had strong community support. We've been efficient in the operations. The course managers are doing a terrific job.
So let me ask you this question. Does anybody say we're undercutting the private golf courses, or are we?
No.
I was just curious because, I mean, this is a marked improvement. $3 million.
I've heard that we, not that we're undercutting at all, but in some cases, why don't we charge less?
Yeah.
So it's actually the other way, if any comments at all, but that's minimal. Those are anecdotal and rare.
But that would be my next question. Why don't we, you know, if the idea is to have golf break even. I mean, Debbie, what do you think?
I mean, this is a whole reinvestment strategy. I mean, yeah. When we were upside down 1.8, 1.7, 1.3, 1.1, you know, over the last number of years, the reinvestment, owning the golf cars, putting cart paths in at Big Met, looking at Shawnee Hills Golf Course, looking at the reinvestment in Seneca, where we were only getting 300,000, we're at 1.3 now, we're 1.35, somewhere in there. So the reality is that what we get, we actually look at putting back in. We need a new maintenance facility at Manakiki. We needed a shed down at Seneca. So what revenues we do get, we will do a buy ahead program. We'll put back into the golf courses. At some point in time, we'll need to look at a driving range and the expansion, the finishing of Seneca. We originally promised 27, minimum of 27 holes. We'll look to do the 36 to finish that project out. But the clubhouse at some point in time, we'll need to get a renovation, new roof. You're going to see in the board action for Manakiki. So we do go against those. We need to do pump stations. So there's enough projects to definitely take the number down.
Yeah.
Prices are comparable to other public courses, but our quality is far higher. I mean, I golf all around on the public side, and I think the numbers are give or take a dollar up or down.
Yeah.
But our quality is consistently higher.
We happen to have an employee guest here today that may actually want to weigh in on it. So I won't steal his thunder for his employee guest introduction, but Damian, if you'd like to give us your thoughts. Welcome. Good morning and welcome.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Yeah, appreciate the invite. I couldn't agree more with Mr. Zimmerman what he was saying. I think the fact that Metro Parks wants to reinvest into their properties is a huge factor. And again, you know, looking at the other public facilities and, you know, my short time here, I've tried to get to as many as I can. that statement about our quality, we offer a superior product at a really, really affordable rate. And I think we're in that sweet spot of where we can give pretty close to private level conditions at an affordable, accessible rate. So I think we are really in that sweet spot for affordability. And, you know, giving guests, you know, I hear it all the time. Folks come to Sleepy and Manakiki and they come from out of town. I mean, this place should be $85 and we're, you know, in the mid 50s. So again, I think we're in that perfect sweet spot for what our mission is and what we're trying to do, accessible, affordable goal.
So as well, you can't say enough about how much
the facilities, all the facilities are fantastic.
Yeah. Big Med is great. Yep. They're all nice.
So the idea is still to sort of break even on golfing, you know, with the additional stuff you're doing.
You know, I'm going to say yes, but I would also say that you're going to see during the work session, the paradigm shift from where we were from a cost recovery model, which was in the 17s, now we're in the 39s. So we've done a really nice job of trying to balance some of those things. When I first got here in 2010, we were subsidizing the zoo by 70%. In 2019, we got that subsidy down, net subsidy down to 39%. What that allows us to do is other things, other investments. We have to keep in mind that we did lose certain levels of funding, the interest rates, where we were getting, you know, $1 million a year off of our interest. We're getting 200,000, 250, maybe less. It just depends on how that goes. So we've been able to figure out how to do things, how to reinvest, and how to continue the product. By buying all the golf cars gives us the stability to be able to earn that revenue versus a revenue share, driving that model forward where we're actually able to reinvest in the proper fashions.
I've got a different question, and it's contextual to market. If we have a sense over like this last 10-year period about our golf operations have evolved. Is there a larger market? You know, there was talk for the longest time that popularity was on the wane. And of course, with COVID, things jumped up again. But beyond that bump, do we have some sense that, for example, we stimulate the marketplace or that we're finding that there are a lot more people? I thought that, like with the First Tee program, it seemed like the expansion is tied as a reaction to a renewed interest.
Yeah, no, I think certainly COVID, it's okay. I certainly think COVID played a role in that. You know, I think, you know, over the last 10 years, it has been a kind of a plateauing of golf. We were losing golfers in droves in the early 2000s. I think that has certainly plateaued. And I think with COVID has allowed people to, you know, we were one of the only activities you could social distance and you're outside and you could still, you know, interact with your friends and coworkers and family. And, you know, so long golf has focused on attracting new golfers, which is great. But one of the things I always try to focus on is those golfers, what we call lost golfers, who would put their clubs down for whatever reason. I think COVID allowed us to bring some of those fat folks back. And I think they've fallen back in love with golf. And, you know, one of the great things about the Metro Parks is we offer, you know, championship level golf and we offer entry level golf with 9-hole facilities. So you don't have to, you know, take 5.5 hours out of your day to enjoy golf. You can go to Mastic Woods, you can go to Washington and play in an hour and 15 minutes and still enjoy and be outside and get some activity. So, you know, that certainly played a piece. And a key thing for me is to hold on to those lost golfers that have come back, you know, making sure we're engaging them, offering them, you know, accessible golf, accessible, affordable golf. So holding on to those golfers are going to be very, very key moving forward.
I think if you start to look at merchandise sales too, people are buying, reinvesting, you know, clubs where they were in their, you know, mid 90s level clubs. We've seen a resurgence and actually we have a challenge right now. We're having trouble buying supplies, golf balls, clubs. And so a lot of those things are challenged. The other thing I think very creatively that COVID taught us instead of the 8-minute tee times, we've gone to 10-minute tee times, and customer satisfaction is up because we have less jamming on the golf course. And so there's been some real positives out of it. And again, I want to thank our volunteer program that helps kind of ranger the courses as well. They're a key part to this. So everybody that's pitched in, and we're very happy to have Damian here as well. So
there are days when you can't get a tee time on the weekends. I mean, it's definitely full. So
it's a great problem to have.
Yes, exactly. But I agree with you. I think the 10 minutes makes it just a little bit nicer. So
satisfaction's up, and revenues continue to hold.
Very good job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Just quickly touching on a third course basis, we can see again, green represents higher revenue, higher margin that we had last year. In the areas where we see the yellow and the red, that just is simply because we have more operational expenses, mainly due to having additional staff at Little Met and Mastic that we didn't have last year. But you can see they're both still operating in the surplus perspective. We just drove some more costs to those locations that we weren't able to handle last year where we did not have the staff. Jumping to enterprise, this is the one area that does not yet resemble 2019. We are 1.1 million ahead of 2020, but we are 2.3 million behind 2019. It's about 42% from a revenue perspective, so it's meaningful. When we look at the expenses, our expenses are about 673,000 more than 2020. We've had more open this year than we did in 2020 driving that. But we are about 1.8 million less in operating expenses in 2019, trying to offset as much of the revenue decrease from 19 as possible. So what this means from an operating surplus perspective is we're at about 401,000 more for 20 than we were in 2020 at this point, but we're about 565,000 less than we had in 2019. But still notable, we are in an operating surplus position so far through August, even given the challenges that we've had this year. So really, I view that as a significant positive and a great job by the team. And then jumping down to the net surplus after CapEx, you can see that we are, even again, in spite of the challenges, we're at about a net surplus of $149,000 for the year across the board for our enterprise operations.
Bill, do you think there's any wisdom in setting up some sort of a sinking fund or recognizing potential depreciation on docks? Because that is a really expensive thing that will come up. You know, we've got the freezing lake, and it's, so every 15 years, you're going to probably have a multi-million dollar expense.
We have started such a fund in 2019 where we incrementally add to it year over year, expecting shoreline improvements and dock repairs because of things like weather and the damage they can do. So it accretes over time. We build that up over time, but we are starting to fund for exactly that.
Okay, because I think that's the kind of thing that will probably build capacity as more things are going on the lakefront. There'll be a bigger need for docks, and to build them, you know, I think, you know, like with golf, you know, the big pitch was try to make it so it's self-funding. So the lady at the checkout lady doesn't have to pay for someone's golf habit, and it's been fabulously successful and will be successful in the future, I'm sure. But and we ought to have the same thing for boating. You know, we ought to make sure that it's self-funding.
We agree completely. And on a marina by marina basis, so far we're in good shape in terms of self-funding, but building that reserve up is a critical piece of it. The infrastructure component, should it get damaged by a storm, could take that profitability away quickly. So we are building that up.
But it might be a nice thing to show in numbers like this. Sure. Just showing that the fact that we're doing it, and there's some measure of it, and maybe getting an idea of what that cost might be.
Okay, absolutely. We can do that for sure. So it's actually a good transition. When we look at the by location, we can see from a performance perspective where we're at. Beach House, East 55th Restaurant, and Emerald Necklace Restaurant are all performing better than they were in 2020. The Beach House is about 452,000 less revenue than 2019, about 110,000 less operating margin. East 55th Marina resembles 2019 very closely in terms of revenue and operating margin. East 55th Restaurant is about 131,000 less revenue, about 40,000 less operating margin than 2019. When we look at the Emerald Necklace Marina, that also 2021 also does resemble 2019, just like East 55th Marina. Emerald Necklace Restaurant, about $293,000 less than 2019, but only about $12,000 less than operating margin. Again, so in going through all these, even though we have significant revenue decreases, we're trying to offset as much of that as possible and preserve the margin by controlling our variable expenses.
I think with Edgewater too, just keep in mind from the 19, there was Edgewater Live. So yes, that's the big delineator there was that series doesn't exist. So
full offerings, full menu, Edgewater Live series. This year, limited offerings, no Edgewater Live series, and still maintaining a profitable position for us. And then just to take a quick look at our remaining locations, as we zip through here real fast, we can see Edgewater Pier comparable to 2020, about 50% less revenue and expense than 2019. Wallace Lake is also comparable to 2020, about 50% less revenue and expense as well than 2019. Huntington, now with the Noshery, is about 132,000 more than 2019, about 52,000 more in operating margin. Ledge Lake is about 52,000 behind 2019, but only about 16,000 less margin. And parking is down roughly 25% from where it was in 2019. And that's very similar to what we saw in last month's analysis as well. So unless there's any questions at a high level, that's where we're at through August.
Very good.
Thank you.
Brian.
Excellent job, Bill. And again, you know, thanking the entire team through, you know, what we're managing through on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis. They've done a fantastic job and really capturing things. The very first action item is the 2021 budget adjustment number 9. Bill.
Thank you, Brian. Budget adjustment number 9, budget adjustment number 9 is for $805,565. $250,000 of that is for increased revenue over budget. $556,000 of that is for new and existing restricted fund appropriations. So the recommended action, the detail of which can be found on pages 32 to 34. So the recommended action falls on the bottom of page 9 to approve budget adjustment number 9.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the authorization of the 2022 tax levy amounts and rates.
By statute, we need to have a resolution adopted by the Board of Park Commissioners for accepting the amounts and rates determined by the Cuyahoga County Budget Commission. And then authorizing the county to levy those necessary taxes, which are laid out here. No change from prior years in our current levy cycle. We're still at 2.7 mil for the outside millage limit and 0.05 mil for the inside millage limit. Recommended action falls in the middle of page 10.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is linking Cleveland Metro Parks and Medina County Park District. This is an authorization to submit a grant application. This is for the Old Field property in Hinckley Reservation. This is a very unique opportunity for the park. It is a 5.8 acre parcel of land. We did negotiate out successfully. We will look to partner with Medina County Park District. They plan to acquire 101 acres on the south side of Ledge Road, Allerdale North, which is part of their park connection. This is a very good opportunity for our park district and the Medina County Park District to set up a link opportunity. As we can see, I-271 does bifurcate it at this point in time, but the opportunity to get closer is a very good thing. There are other trails that do go over I-80 that do link park districts together. So this is just a nice step forward to make that connection right there. So the recommended action, if there are no questions, fall on the top mid portion of page 12 to enter into a resolution for the Ohio Public Works Commission through the NREC District number 9 for the Old Field property.
Move to approve, but I do have a question.
Second.
Let's wait for
this. Is there any plan to get over 271?
The hope is after the acquiring of it.
It's the potential to trigger.
A cost analysis has not been done, but the opportunity to link the park districts, I think, is one of our long-term goals. I don't know that we've spanned an interstate yet. We've spanned railroad tracks, so this is going to be a whole new.
It's the bridge to the west.
The state road.
That state.
Yep.
So is that piece of property that would connect the two? Is that?
Yeah, what's on the east, south side, 270 east of state?
I'm not as familiar with that.
keep going north. There.
Yeah.
No?
We will be looking at it. I'm not sure what Medina County Park District's plans are yet, as we're just applying for the grants, so.
Okay, the motion's on the table.
Yes, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
We will get back to you. The next action item is an authorization to accept a land donation and provide in-kind services. This is in the Richfield Township's Rising Valley Park. This is part of the Hinckley Reservation. This is 44.7 acres. This property has come up numerous times dating back to 2003, 2004, the involvement in the 228 Rising Valley Park area. They were jointly deeded by the United States. This was actually used as a tank proving ground, which I think is absolutely fascinating, that we're in the process of working on the perpetual protection of this. It looks like a metro park. It feels like a metro park, but Richfield Township had been the stewards and shepherds of this. We had talked to them over a period of time. There was some money that was attached directly to it in the amount of about $30,000. That's where the balance came from for in-kind services to help the Richfield Joint Recreation District. So that's how we partnered together to do that. So there is no fee for the acquisition. We're providing in-kind services to help out with the Joint Recreation District. As you can see, there's trails connected, and there's a sign that actually has our logo already on it.
We're good to go.
Eager beavers.
You're ready to go.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is the 2022 Cleveland Metro Parks Group Healthcare Benefits. I will turn it over to Matt.
Good morning.
Morning.
So it's time of year again when we're looking ahead to for sign selections and area selections. Just by way of background, we operate primary spend, we have about a between $7.5-8 million total spend on our benefits package, depending on claims experience. The bulk of that spend is on our self-insured medical plan. We pay dollar for dollar for medical claims up to a stop-loss deductible that's currently at $175,000 per claim. We carry a contract with a medical insurance carrier, currently Cigna, to administer the plan, claims adjudication, network discounts, and population health improvement programs. So the employee experience is as if we were a Cigna client, but we are paying the claims on the back end. We offer our employees three medical insurance plan options, a base PPO, our plan B, a higher cost, lower deductible, plan A buy-up PPO, and we do offer a high deductible health plan with an associated health savings account. Employees contribute between 5% and 18% of the premium, depending both on their union status and their plan selection, which has changed over time. As you remember, maybe 10 years ago when employees were not contributing to the plans, we've gotten that to an equitable state at this point. In addition to the self-insured medical plan, we offer a wide array of fully insured supplemental benefits, dental vision, lifelong term disability, other disability programs, and some employee assistance programs and flexible spending accounts. So we have a very competitive total benefits package that we offer to our employees. Here's a look back. Again, our main cost driver is the dollars that we spend on the actual medical claims. And you can see this trend line, this dates back to 2013. We saw a significant uptick in the early part of that decade. In 2016, we switched coverage from Medical Mutual to Cigna. And since then, we've seen a flattening and even a reduction in our claims experience. We're at about a 4.4 negative percent trend since 2016 on our medical claim spend, which is remarkable in the face of, you know, a 6-7% positive trend in the market over that period of time. And in conjunction with that, we do pay fixed fees. So we pay for the stop loss insurance and we pay Cigna for the administrative services. So while our claims experience has been going down,
our administrative fees have not markedly increased, and in fact, they've decreased over the past several years. So Cigna's been a very good partner for us since 2016.
Matt, is that attributable to anything, or is it just sort of luck of the draw?
I will never deny that there's some luck involved in it. I mean, there's certain things you can't prevent, cancer cases, childbirth difficulties. But we've done a lot of engagement, both on our plan designs, educating employees on consumerism, working with Cigna to manage population health, which is some of the things I want to talk about here.
Okay.
We've engaged our population through Cigna. Cigna does a markedly better job, in our opinion, of engaging our employees in their healthcare as opposed to our prior carrier. We see preventive care 17% above benchmark rates. Our well visits are 20% above benchmark rates. We've used our wellness program incentives along with Cigna's engagement to really drive that preventive care, getting people in, getting them treated and in, rather than inpatient care down the road for something like diabetes. We're getting them early, they're complying with their medication. So we're seeing there's some short-term costs when somebody goes on a prescription, but that's a lot cheaper in the long run than inpatient hospital stays. And so we're seeing above average compliance with all of our maintenance medications. Employers are using generic prescriptions. So we're doing all the things that we can do. Now there's always going to be the potential for that catastrophic claim. We're going to have a bad year at some point, but we're doing all the things that are within our control. And
those are really good numbers. I mean, that's a significant impact.
It's outstanding. And those numbers we expect to actually increase this year. Last year was obviously the anomaly. People weren't going to the doctor.
Right.
So we're hopeful that when the numbers come in for 2021, we see, we've been even higher than that in the past. So
Matt, can you go back to the slide, the graph again?
Let me see.
I think it's two back. Yeah, right there. It's interesting that it is quite an increase, a doubling in the fixed fee. Is that sort of representative of the fixed fee from 500 to a million? Is that typical over that period of time? Would the fixed fees have doubled? Because there's no insurance built into that, right? It's all managed.
The stop loss insurance is the primary driver of that, and that is between 15% to 20% renewals.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's the part over 175.
Yep.
That's
been very volatile. That market is extremely volatile. We, as you'll see when we talk about the contract renewals here in a second, we still have not finalized our stop loss renewal. The carriers are very apprehensive, primarily driven by the prescription market, the high end specialty biological medications. We've paid for prescriptions that are $100,000 per script because there's some amazing drugs coming, but the cost that comes with them. So the carriers are very apprehensive. They're really
loading the
risk on us. And so, but Cigna, we had a flat renewal last year in stop loss. They've been very fair with us. We had a back and forth negotiation with them, and they worked with us. And so the fact that we've been relatively flat since 2018 and even a downward trend is a positive, because we're looking, we've got our stop loss renewals. We're seeing 15-25% renewals because they're scared of those high costs.
And the summer employees don't get this.
No, this is full time only.
And is the employment been about constant in that period?
We were very low pre levy in 2013. Some of this cost increase here was due to a post levy hiring increase, but we've been relatively flat since 14 through. Current, we've actually trended a little bit down in employees on the plan. That's more to do with some of our plan design features that we've implemented, but it's been pretty steady since 2014-15 area on the plan, the actual numbers.
Thanks, that's great.
So plan management, which I just mentioned, over the past 7 or 8 years, we've really made an effort to make sure that our plan designs are competitive with the market. We were frankly much more generous than the market previously, but we've put equitable plan design features, deductibles, and copays that match the market, and that really make that share between the employee and the employer more equitable going forward. And that has helped with some of our cost containment. We've also focused on spousal redirection to their own employment. If spouses of our employees have jobs and have healthcare offered, we have put spousal surcharges in place to move those spouses to their own employer's health plans. And that's resulted in a 16% reduction in spouses in our plan. Because we had, our research indicated that spouses were 50% more expensive than our actual employees on our plan. So that's been a focus of our attention. Now spouses are still permitted on our plan. We do have a surcharge in place. And if the spouse does not have healthcare elsewhere, they are permitted with no surcharge on our plan. So it's fair, it's not punitive, but it has saved us money. This year was it was a busy summer for us in benefits administration. All of our major contracts were up for renewal. We had RFPs out on all of our lines of coverage. We are recommending in your action items a 3-year renewal with Cigna for medical plan administration. They've given us an overall cost reduction. Again, it was a very competitive process. We had a couple of other carriers that were aggressively trying to get our business. So we were able to negotiate some cost reductions with Cigna. We think they've been a great partner for us. We've seen that negative claims trend line. We hope that continues, and we don't see a reason to change that relationship at this point. We're proposing continuing with Cigna for dental and vision, our fully insured lines at very incremental market rate increases. We are proposing a new contract with Medical Mutual of Ohio, provide our life and disability insurance. They've proposed reduced rates. They're a local business, obviously, that we want to partner with. Our previous carrier was Cigna on that line of coverage, but Cigna sold that book of business to New York Life, and their rates were a little bit higher, and we have not necessarily experienced a great same level of service since that transition. So we think Medical Mutual will be a good partner going forward. From a plan design standpoint, we're going to keep our plan designs where they're at from a deductible copay standpoint. We don't have the final premiums yet because we're still negotiating with stop loss. We'll probably be back in October or November with that contract. We're waiting on the carriers to finalize their bids, but we're anticipating minimal changes to the premiums because our claims experience continues to trend in a positive direction. So with that being said, any questions?
No, it's thorough.
Thank you. Good presentation.
Thank you.
That was excellent.
Thanks.
Matt, Harold, and the entire team did an excellent job. It's not laborious. It just takes time to get through and really look at. And we're very happy to have a local company come back into the fray with Medical Mutual. So a lot of real positives out of this. The recommended action falls all the way through page 17.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
We will move into the tabulation of award and bids. They all fall on the top portion of page 18, Manikiki Clubhouse Shake Roof Replacement, pavement markings. We're adding an ADA accessible kayak launch at the East 55th Marina.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Here we have vouchers.
We have two vouchers and payroll resolutions. First one of which, following vouchers, have been reviewed as to legality of expenditure and conformity to Ohio Revised Code, totaling $9,917,819.81, with the recommended action on the bottom of page 27 to approve.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And then the second resolution for vouchers, also having been reviewed as to legality and conformity with ORC, a total amount of $384.39 specific to Arborware. Recommended action on the middle of page 28.
I'll abstain here.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
Let's see, now we have public comments. Yes, one.
Morning. Safety is one area where foresight can really pay off. Given all our present challenges, it is hard to keep an even keel to maintain consistency, particularly for law enforcement. Though some aspects of policing must change, the public still expects fair and consistent enforcement to ensure their respect. Certainly churn within Metro Parks law enforcement, particularly at the top, has made this very difficult. 5 chiefs in 10 years is not a good thing and must make recruiting for lower positions more difficult. Outsourcing of dispatch was not only demoralizing, but also created new issues. Furthermore, slow walking blotter reports to local media adds to doubts. Adding alcohol lubricates bad behavior, pulling officers from other reservations where their regular visibility is both deterrent and reassurance. We see frequent hirings here, but I am unsure how many stay on. Retirements have depleted the ranks of experienced officers who could provide the mentoring for new and often youthful recruits. Good policing calls for experience as well as training. So here we are again, searching for a new chief and hoping yet again that Metro Parks Police can regain the reputation and respect they enjoyed when they were called only Rangers. Actions speak louder than names. Realistically, foresight and planning are mandatory for safety. I read that the Cedar Point Bridge North sidewalk will be eliminated in favor of a single wider APT along the south side. Were any observations done of current pedestrian behavior?
Sorry about that.
Folks choose the north side down at the river. They also use the north side walking to and from the parking lots and field, which are all on that same side. Why force them to cross the road twice? Except for rare events, Frostville serves as a parking lot. From there, visitors cross to the north side trails. Denying pedestrians their preferred path only encourages jaywalking and will worsen existing conflicts at the light. That intersection already has car and bike right turn interfering with the APT crosswalk. You must not create an additional hazard. Swapping two sidewalks for a free APT could be a lethal bargain. Many things contribute to making the park safe, and often it comes down to management's ability to prevent problems. The law enforcement has less to deal with. Thank you.
As a clarifier, I'm not sure where she came up with five chiefs. Chief Loftus retired, Chief Pulaski retired, Chief Vittori retired. We had interim Chief Sabota, and we have Chief Dolan. And I'm not sure what new challenges she's actually referring to.
I think we all agree that a good police force is critical, it seems to me that we have a good police force, but I think everything can be improved, and any comments that can help certainly will be listened to.
Again, I echo those sentiments. I think we have an extremely well-positioned police force. Law enforcement is challenging right now, certainly, and we will be bringing forward, the process by which we bring on the new chief here shortly.
Very good. Are there any other public comments? We can go on to information briefing.
The first information briefing is someone we have already heard from today. Joe is going to introduce our employee guest.
My pleasure to reintroduce Damian Cosby, the new director of golf. It was a journey that we set on to find the best, and I think we really did when we found Damian. We were looking for somebody who had private experience, public experience, somebody who had experience dealing with unions. We're really looking for a unicorn out there. So we knew we were looking at a very small group of people out there in the country that had this type of experience that resonated with what we have here to offer. And when Damian came through the door, he blew our socks off, and we went after him. And I think we hit a home run, and he's resonating well with the staff. He has some great ideas for the future. You heard him speak earlier. He obviously understands the game very well. We welcome him and his family to Northeast Ohio.
Thanks for those kind words. I don't know if I can necessarily fuck all that up. I hope I can. But no. Yeah. Again, thank you. Really excited to be here. Excited to be part of a really, really fantastic team. Through my first couple months here, I've told several people that normally when I've changed jobs, it's always been a cleanup effort. You got to go and reset standards and hire new staff. And here I don't have to do any of that. The staff is really, really great. Our support teams are great. So I am in a really, really lucky position to come in and work with a team of really fantastic professionals, great superintendents, good golf operations folks, and the Metro Parks as a whole is a fantastic organization. So I am extremely lucky and blessed to have this opportunity, and I'm going to grab it by both horns and go as fast as far as we can. So I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any questions for me?
So glad to have you.
Be careful what you ask for. The next info item is the Government Finance Officers Association Distinguished Budget Award Presentation for 2021. This is our 29th consecutive year Cleveland Metro Parks has won the award. It is the highest principles of government budgeting. Bill was challenged with not breaking the streak. He has lived up to the challenge, and we very much appreciate the way our budget is presented on a national and international level, because this is with Canada as well. So I'd love to give them a huge round of congratulations. It's a huge challenge he was undertaking, but it does show our fiscal responsibility. So congratulations to our whole finance team.
Is there an award? I mean,
it's a little button.
It's already hanging.
It's a button or a.
There's a plaque, and each year that plaque gets updated with a little medallion that sticks on for the year that you win it. So,
gotcha.
Fortunately, we've got no empty spaces in the last 29 years.
It's great.
The button is Cleveland Fed quarterbacks.
Private equity guy makes good. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Private equity guy makes good.
So far, I'm trying to keep it alive.
The next info item we have is the Foster's Run Restoration Project in North Chagrin Reservation. This is part of the H2 Ohio program. Sean?
Thanks, Brian. Good morning, commissioners. Excited to be in front of you this morning on a project that has been a bit in the making. And due to our incredible natural resources team and our development team, this is a fully funded project with outside dollars. So I'm going to walk you through quickly. It is always great. So first of all, Foster's Run, let's give you that location. We are on the south side of North Chagrin Reservation. So just we're in a pocket of the woods north of Wilson Mills Road and east of Somme Center Road. Some of you probably know this area pretty well. It is wonderful to always start with a master plan and then be able to show you exactly where the master plan calls for an improvement that we are then executing upon. And this instance is no different. So when we went through our master planning process, we identified Foster's Run, which sits in the upper 40, as we call it internally. The upper 40 itself.
Externally too.
Yes. The upper 40 itself consisted of several life estates where by 2018, the term of those estates had, we'll say, sunset, if you will. And in 2018, we demolished several outbuildings, one very unique barn that we disassembled, and three homes. So that then gave us the opportunity to then look forward to where we are today in 21-22 to restore a section of the creek that is in that area. And this builds upon some former work that was done in Foster's Run in collaboration with Mayfield Village in 2008. So there's been a really good amount of investment here, including work that we're just finishing up at Beecher's Brook. And we are about ready to reopen that trailhead at Wilson Mills Road we've got a new bridge for the trail and a completely reinvigorated and reinstated stream bed for Beecher's Brook in that location. So quickly here, we've seen a little bit of degradation, if you will, in the stream. You can see some head cutting here on the left. And since it was priorly developed, this is an exact type project with a wetland restoration and stream restoration that the H2 Ohio project looks to fund, because we will be improving water quality in the Greater Lake Erie Basin. So what we'll do here is we will take out about 3/4 of an acre of impervious areas, so driveways, a small dam and culverts. We'll do a decompaction effort, so then we can allow the sites to infiltrate better, plant more trees, and then we will create about 0.4 acres of wetlands and restore about 1,400 linear feet of stream on that main stem of Foster's, all with the funds that are available.
At the circle, the turnaround, the cul-de-sac circle, and upstream is that big prison gate. I mean, it looks like, yeah. What's happening with that? Is that going out or is that being refurbished? Because that's kind of the catch.
Correct. We are determining exactly what to do with it. If we were to take, there's a large culvert under there, and if we were to take that out, we would probably wipe out our budget immediately.
That's why I asked.
So the culvert will likely stay, but the treatments upstream and downstream.
So you could be able to retard up above, so it's less stress.
That's exactly correct.
Where is the parking lot on, just on that previous slide, the parking lot on Wilson Mills?
So I apologize for the clarity here, because we're at quite a level where it's tough to see, but.
Oh, down there. Okay. Okay. I see.
So I apologize with the map. So some quick facts, $500,000 project that is with engineering and the capital improvements from our under 50 list. So that's under $50,000. We've hired both Biohabitats and Chagrin Valley Engineering to come up with the design package. We have released an RFQ for construction manager at risk. We expect to be before you in October with a recommendation to hire the construction manager for this project. And ODNR really challenged us here. They awarded only a few months ago and said, we'd like you to be done by the end of June. We said June of 23. They said, no, June of 22. Ooh, okay, wow. We will do it. So that's where we are. We're moving fast, but we're going to get it done, weather dependent. And wanted to put this in front of you today, because we're about ready to bring the contractor to you next month.
Cool.
Great update, Sean. Mm-hmm. The next is the Euclid Creek Reservation Trails update. Sarah's going to take over to give an update on all of the work that we're doing on the east side.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So I know I've been in front of you many times over the last year, especially with Euclid Creek Reservation. So I'm going to give just a general overview of what we're doing there, as well as some additional projects. I've talked to you a lot about the Euclid Creek Greenway project, how we're taking that phase by phase. But there's some other important work that's going on there with another Eastern Connector Trail that we'll talk about briefly, and then work that NOAACA is doing with regional planning through the TLCI program, as well as the county's lakefront public access study, and also just briefly on East 185th Rehabilitation and Streetscape project. There's also plenty of other projects that the city of Euclid is doing themselves with their waterfront plan and other connections, trails along Euclid, things to report in this area. So the Euclid Creek Greenway has long been established as a priority to link what had been the state's portion of the lakefront parks that we took over in 2013 and the lower portion of Euclid Creek Reservation, one of the legacy reservations. So it's not an easy route to get up there, especially once you get to the railroad tracks and I-90. And so the map just shows that there have been various iterations of what that final route will look like. But in terms of planning, it's been a long precedent that we want to make this connection. And we talked about it also in the Eastside Greenway plan and then the subsequent Cuyahoga Greenways plan. And this is identified as one of those critical gaps, one of 12 critical gaps in the entire county that needs to be filled. And it's also part of our reservation master planning. This is a blow up of a section for Euclid Creek Reservation from 2015, also referenced in the 2019 lakefront portion master plan. But you can see, if I do this correctly, called out changing the intersection here at Highland and Euclid Creek Parkway to make that safer, making that connection up towards the lakefront. And so that's part of what we have done. We put it in our plans. We're following our plans. We're executing on that.
Now, can you go back? Sure. Just one. So how do you, with that slide there, mm-hmm. how do you get over Euclid Avenue? Yeah.
Careful. We jump.
Yes, for this one, it was just always contemplated a at grade crossing using the existing crosswalk over here.
Okay, so you'd like the fire station is right
right over here.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll pull it up in the next map. Oh, okay. Kind of talk through it. And we were contemplating a hawk signal at that point in 2015 before, as part of that reservation master planning, before we did the Emerald Necklace trail crossing study, which actually proved out that a full signal was warranted for that.
Full signal is
warranted. So we did, based on a reservation master planning, you know, additional study, additional planning, and then that informed our recommendations and what we're ultimately going after.
So a signal at a high.
Yeah, full signal.
Because it's too tight.
We're not doing it at Euclid because there's also a study to look at whether this longer leg of Chardon can be removed.
Oh,
and that, yeah, and that's, that also came about as part of the intersection study, intersection crossing study that we did with NOAACA, and now the city of Euclid is pursuing that through a technical assistance grant with NOAACA.
Can I ask a question on that signal though? That so when we make that kind of determination, are we putting in the signal? Is the city putting in the signal? And how easy is it to?
We are paying for the signal to go in. The city is going to absorb that into their maintenance.
Okay.
They will be responsible for the
money to make sure it happens.
About 200,000 for the signal. And as you might remember last summer, I was in front of you talking about a safety funds application for the signal. Ultimately, we were unsuccessful with an ODOT safety funds application for the signal, but I have some good news to tell you about in the next slide. So we try lots of different avenues to stitch all these projects together. Yes, exactly. So just showing the overall route for the first three phases of Euclid Creek Greenway. And then for this first phase in orange, it's about a half a mile, and it includes the new traffic signal and intersection modification. So that's taking out that slip lane to make it more of a proper T intersection, safer for everyone. And estimated cost is about $630,000. We were awarded back in, all the way back in January of 2018 from an application that was from spring of 2017, CMAQ awards, the Congestion Mitigation Air Quality funding through NOAACA and the statewide program. We were awarded only about 40% of what our original ask had been. And then we were given a little bit of a surprise this summer when NOAACA said that they were looking back at their past applications and decided to give us full.
Wow.
A full award.
That's
great. Yeah, a booster shot, exactly. So we are basically being made whole of our original request that was for $499,000. In the meantime, we had put in, you know, that safety funds application, we're unsuccessful in that, but then had also put in a Clean Ohio request that included, that was from April of this year, included phase one as well as phase two. And so we were recommended at the NOAACA board meeting last week for the funding, for this additional funding for CMAQ. It does have to go through the statewide committee and final approvals that'll happen in October, November. And at that point, if we're, you know, successful, fully successful in getting that additional CMAQ funds, we'll communicate that back to ODNR about the pending Clean Ohio request.
Does CMAQ money come to us directly, or does it also, does it have to go to the city?
No, it's through us directly. Okay. It's part of the LPA process with ODOT.
So we'll build the trail, but the city will build the signal.
We'll build the signal. It'll just go into their inventory. But we've been coordinating with the city, and they've been extremely helpful. And so they've gone through with, they've seen our signal design plans and all that. We submitted stage three design. So we already have a project and an LPA agreement with ODOT for this part. And so we can just add those additional funds in. So
that's high, but on Euclid, so there are two options waiting to see if it's vacated.
Well,
would that be a crossing point?
Well, as we have it designed and scoped out right now, we are stopping right at Euclid and utilizing the existing crosswalks to get to the old Central Middle School site. Looking into the future, we could do some additional modifications, but this project of looking at that leg of Chardon has been, it's been bumped a couple of years of the technical assistance to see through NOAACA whether that leg can be removed, because it does require a geometric changes to that section of Chardon, and one is a state route, and so redesignation of the state route. So there's some work that goes into it. But yes, ultimately, I think if that leg goes away, that changes our options. But there is an existing crosswalk right there, so we are utilizing that in the meantime.
Sarah, it's impossible to, like taking the yellow line, and instead of going up to the right and following Chardon Road,
going along the side of the river. I know the sewer district had that, the water treatment thing. Yes. So going up on the, excuse me, on the east side of the river.
One of the main issues we have is there is a 54-inch water line that goes through to the treatment facility.
Okay, okay.
Because we looked at that.
Physical.
Yeah.
Not security.
Right, because it connects in.
Security goes to the next side.
Got it.
It's at an angle and the angle, they're in conflict with each other.
Yeah, and that.
This actually integrates the neighborhood a little bit.
That's a good point.
And it does, because of the line there, it does limit what we can do with the central middle school site in terms of restoration work that was originally, you know, scoped out in that 2007 Euga Creek Greenway plan. We have executed a lot of the recommendations for restoration, like the Oxbow up in the northern portion of the Euga Creek Reservation was from that 2007 plan. Some of the floodplain restoration work that was called out can't be done because of the existing infrastructure.
Okay.
So phase two, again, this is part of that Clean Ohio Trails Fund request that we will find out about hopefully November, December timeline or timeframe. And so it's to get the trail through that portion of Central Middle School. The building is down on Central Middle School. It has not transferred to us. Those 17 acres haven't transferred to us yet. But just the concept plan of what that site would look like. And we have a soil decompaction GLRI, Great Lakes Restoration Initiative project on that site as well to, you know, decompact the soil so it can drain better. Again, the scope of what we could do was a little bit limited given some of the restrictions on the site, but there'll be plantings there as well. A lot of tree plantings on the site. And then the third phase, taking the trail up Chardon to St. Clair, is about 0.6 miles. And we were recommended again last week through NOAACA's board to receive our full funding request of just over $1 million, likely for 2026 construction year. That can change a little bit if they have some openings in their program to bump it up a little bit. So we will find out when the statewide committee through the Ohio Association of Regional Councils meets in November. But we were, each MPO, Metropolitan Planning Organization, that's part of OARC, is able to award for the statewide competition bonus points for four projects that they consider to be especially regionally significant. And so we were number two of the four regionally significant projects that they're putting down to the statewide committee for CMAC funds. So we were given 7 bonus points for this application. So I think we're in a good position to get that full request. And then also, you know about the RAISE planning grant application that we put in July. So that includes the feasibility for figuring out what that final route is to get up to the lakefront, because there are so many constraints. So that would cover things like the traffic analysis and some public engagement and doing that work to figure out what is the preferred route.
What is the timing on that?
NEF is an option. That wasn't one of the highest ones. The most recent one had it going up Nottingham, and it's just, you're really constrained through there. And East 185th had been talked about at one point, but you'll see in kind of the final set of slides, Sharrows are just going in on 185th because that's more of a commercial corridor that the cities of Euclid and Cleveland want to keep for redevelopment.
Right.
But we'll find out about the RAISE planning grant by November 22nd. So hopefully we'll have some more good news. The other trail that I wanted to talk about was that Eastern Connector Trail. So this is part of that Kay Hovanian property acquisition from 2018, but we're making a connection into the Welsh Woods picnic area. There's recreational trails program funding to do work on an ADA accessible trail on the top part. So kind of where that red star is, and it would connect into an aggregate hiking trail that takes you down the slope to a suspension bridge over to the Welsh Woods picnic area, crossing over Euclid Creek.
Oh, that would be terrific.
Yeah. And So that's just what the trail looks like, and the stars kind of line up in the same place. So that's to orient you to where you are in the site. But the yellow part is that the paved trail section. So we're excited about that. And construction on that trail will begin most likely early next year and would be done at least by the end of 2023, somewhere in there. And then outside of Cleveland Metro Parks efforts, we've been working with Cuyahoga County with their lakefront public access plan, and want to highlight where we are with Euclid Creek and with some of the shoreline in City of Cleveland and City of Euclid. That's come through as one of their priority areas throughout the planning process. And again, orienting you looking south onto the shoreline. So Euclid, Euclid Creek Reservation over here, this is the Beulah Park section. Can kind of read it here, East 156th Street. This is an area that has bubbled up as one of the key priorities through that plan. Still in draft, it'll be completed and finalized in the next month or 2 months. But this area here for Beulah Park, making a connection along the lakefront, basically extending from Euclid Creek Reservation at the end of the by the pier area, extending across the lakefront, and also preserving sewer district infrastructure at the same time. Actually, you can see it a little bit better in the pictures down along the bottom here, just how much erosion has occurred, and you can see an outfall there. So there's protection work for other public infrastructure, and the county has also gotten some erosion emergency assistance grant funding. $1 million was just awarded maybe 2 or 3 months ago for this project, and they are looking for additional funding to do the trail portion. Looking at this section right here through Clean Ohio, and then also to, let's see, sorry, the imagery doesn't come out that clearly, but this was also part of our strategic planning, our preservation master planning, to make this connection, to pull you further into the neighborhood so that people can access Euclid Creek Reservation.
Tara, wouldn't to protect the area you've shown, the lakefront, you know, protection from erosion, wouldn't that be millions and millions of dollars?
Yes, it's several million dollars for that project. They're looking at, I think it's about $3.4 million for that section, and it includes a lot of heavy infrastructure work at the toe of the slope, pulling back some of the slope. And I didn't include the diagrams really of what that looks like. You can see a little bit of it in the corner here of just, I mean, these are massive projects, but in this section of the lakefront, I mean, you're seeing heavy erosion, and because there's a lot of additional public infrastructure there with sewer district, they're going to have to do a fix for it. And so this is a way to get a public benefit out of it at the same time, an additional public benefit of extending a trail. And so that's part of what has driven the lakefront public access plan, is where there's that overlap of you're making an investment that's killing two birds with one stone. And so yes, they are not cheap projects though.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And then, as I mentioned too, there's regional transportation for livable communities initiative planning studies. This was from the 2020 round, but NOAACA shifted focus to do 3 large regional studies. And so the lakefront transportation connection study is looking at how do you get people to the lakefront, kind of more of a north-south analysis of major connection points. And then also, we're not sure if this would be included in the regional Metro Parks Trails Transportation Connection Study yet or not. Those projects are just kind of kicking off right now, but those are things to keep in mind for the future of, you know, just additional ways to link in Euclid Creek Reservation to the neighborhoods and the larger network. And then finally, the East 185th Street Rehabilitation Project. This has been also a long time coming. We were part of the planning effort for the streetscape project back in 2013, 2014. And ultimately it was decided that this route, given the limitations of the roadway, would just have sharrows on it. So this is not going to be a major bicycle pedestrian connection point. And that's part of the reason that we really do need to pursue the Euclid Creek Greenway. This corridor is not going to be the route for that. But this is an exciting project. The corridor has a lot of good bones. So the cities of Euclid and Cleveland are working together to do a major streetscape project in two phases. And you can see the timeline here, the construction complete in 2023. So it's in the very near term. And then also making some improvements at the lakefront. There's kind of an interesting intersection, five-point intersection, where one of those legs will be removed at Lakeshore. So that's another project that's going on in the area. So we'll have a lot going in the Euclid area.
Sarah, just a question. The $11 million then, is that that's more than just the street. So it's a whole yes. bunch of stuff.
Yeah, it's so there's a lot of streetscape improvements that are happening there too, crossings, bump outs, but it is a lot of some utility work as well. But it's a pretty decent stretch of roadway too.
And the funding would come from for that?
It's a mixture, but a lot of it is federal funding.
Okay.
But it's running through the cities.
Very good.
Yep.
Get to work.
Sarah, can I have a copy of those slides that you gave me? That would be terrific if you could shoot them to me. Very nice presentation.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Sure thing. I think I'm next.
We will continue with the strategic planning to improve access for all. This is really an update from the 2020 Emerald Necklace Centennial Plan.
I'll try to be a little bit quicker on this one. So we've talked about as part of our strategic planning, what is Cleveland Metro Park's role in ensuring that we have access for everyone into our parks? There's our foundational elements. Why Cleveland Metro Parks exists really is to connect people to parks and to conserve parklands. Those are the two main tenets. And so we focus our work around that. How do we get people to parks so that it benefits their lives? And we use a variety of planning tools. Obviously, we have our original plan that followed the riparian corridors, and we're trying to still execute on that plan. Our strategic directions highlighted, there's a little bit of connections in all of these, honestly, but these were the different key directions or goals where that really shines through, that connection of how do you get people into the parks through trails or through additional parklands that are secured or expanded. So we've been working on this and we'll continue that into our next strategic plan. We use our planning tools, the trail matrix, which has really helped since our last strategic plan of figuring out what projects do we go after, and equity and ability to access people that don't have current access or, you know, ways to get to parks factors heavily into the trails matrix and the work that we do. And also the walk and bike shed analysis. And the last work session, I gave you some details on how we've expanded our walk bike shed access. You know, that's part of that everyone within a half mile, 10 minute walk of a park that we're working towards. Also, our regional trail planning initiatives, that's why we spend a lot of time really working with others to figure out what is the roadmap. So the Cuyahoga Greenways plan that we touched on even in the last presentation is a big guiding element. And access for underserved populations also factored heavily into this planning effort with Cuyahoga Greenways. And talked also last board work session on environmental justice areas. So you can see it's not just limited to city of Cleveland. This is looking at areas with underrepresented populations, minority populations, low income populations that might not have the resources to be able to travel to get to a park. So that is another reason, like, where do we locate? Is there transit access? And those are some of the things that, you know, some of that is not within our control or within our mission, but we are working very hard to fill gaps wherever we can and to make sure that we are providing access to as many people in the county as possible. And so we have lots of projects that have been going on. This is only a sampling of them that have been completed or are underway. Over the last 10 years or so, we have a lot in the offing, but you can see that within that, where that EJ map area was, this kind of core area, we have a lot of projects that we've been working on. We've been very strategic in reaching out. That had been part of the 2012 plan to really make sure that we were relevant and reaching out to underserved communities and looking outside of our traditional boundaries. And so that has led to park expansions and trail expansions. That was not accidental. That was very purposeful because we take the mission of connecting people to parks very seriously. And we have a lot still kind of on the way. So going through and just, I figured pictures would do better than words in explaining how we've met some of those goals that we set out in 2012 of either creating new or expanded parks and new or expanded trails. So taking over the lakefront reservation in 2013 filled a service area for us, put us in places that we had not been in, Cleveland Metro Parks had not been in before, and accessing a greater share of the population for the county. And improvements like the beach house, Euclid Beach, the pier that went in, the pedestrian bridge that went in, the play space at Edgewater Park, the Lindsay Family Play Space, creating Rivergate Park and establishing that new park area to connect all the trails that were planned to go through the area. Merwin's Wharf, again, anchoring that park. Watershed Stewardship Center in Parma, part of our inner ring suburbs, Mill Creek Falls expansion and work that has been done throughout Garfield and much of the work in Garfield Reservation. Euclid Creek Reservation, the expansion that we just talked about, that Cahovanian Homes adding additional acreage. Dunham Park, reaching out to more areas, putting more parkland in that people can access. And then Brighton Park, which just opened as well. And then for new trails or connections, our work with the Towpath Trail, and some of these, it's not, many of these are not just Cleveland Metro Parks exclusive projects. These are partnership projects, as we've talked about many times. These large scale projects usually require, you know, great deal of partnership and coordination. So our work with the Towpath Trail, the Scranton Towpath section, stage three of the Towpath, the Cleveland Foundation Centennial Trail, building those connections, getting people from the towpath to the lakefront, and the partnership with the Trust for Public Land and Land Studio to do that. Adding the water taxi, that's a connection too. You can't build bridges everywhere, so a water taxi is a way to get people from one end of the city to the other. And then, of course, our Tiger Trails, which really filled some of those gaps. And you've seen this slide before, our walk shed and bike shed update, looking at our 2021 update, what percentage of the tax district is within the 10-minute walk shed, half-mile walk shed, or within a 15-minute bike shed. So, you know, we've got more to do on the walk shed. Some of these people, these residents are served by city parks, so it's not like they're in, you know, green space deserts necessarily. This is just for our facilities. But within the EJ population, we're actually pulling more residents are within a 10-minute walk of our facilities than the general population of the tax district, and about the same for the bike shed, because that gets you 3 miles away. And then, and the analysis, just for a refresher, when we compared it to what our walk bike shed looked like in 2015, we really did increase at a greater percentage the percentage of the EJ population that's within that 10-minute or half-mile walk. We increased it all across the board, but our numbers, because of where we were locating trails and parks, we boosted those numbers more than the general population. And then for future parks, expansions or partnerships, Canal Basin Park, we did the initial greening project down here several years ago. This is a City of Cleveland-led project, but we've been partnering with them, getting more green space down into the City of Cleveland. We're doing work on a heritage boat docks and then also our work with the Vision for the Valley Initiative with the county and the port and Flats Forward, and what comes of that, and of course, the CHEERS project. Those are all kind of big initiatives that can lead to future expansions, future park areas. And then for Trails and Partnerships, our RAISE planning grant to get that next slate of projects in the queue to get constructed. Slavic Village Downtown Connector, you've heard me talk about this, trying to work in partnership to get that project moving. The Euclid Creek Greenway, just saw some of these. The partnership with a consortium of many different government entities on Irishtown Bend, and our piece is the continuation of the Cleveland Foundation Centennial Lake Link Trail through that area, and that's a conceptual rendering. And then continuing our work with Cuyahoga Greenways. I feel like we have done a lot. We set out with high goals from the 2012 plan. We're continuing a lot of those goals, and there's much more than I could have put in there of work that had been done. And that's just in the physical connections and park area, not to mention programming and natural resources and a whole other purview beyond what we do necessarily in planning and design, but just in the ways that we've touched the strategic plan and have been executing on it and plan to execute on it into the future.
Yeah, wow.
It's a full drink.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's impressive, and we've got a lot of dedicated people and leadership too to make it all happen, so.
Excellent.
Sarah, can I have the slides of that set too? Oh, thank you very much.
He wants to put them underneath his pillow. I just, you know, when you look back, this is kind of the precursor to the work session, but it's really highlighting the work that we did during our last plan, why it was important, why it was strategic, what we said we were going to do, what we lived up to. And then we'll move into the, you know, the work session in a minute. Just as a matter of housekeeping, there is no executive session. And I do have a change in the agenda. I have an award to give to someone. Joe, if you can please come forward. So because there was limited opportunities to be engaged in person, Joe is being bestowed the President's Award for his appreciation and in appreciation of his leadership of the National Association of County Park and Rec Associations Board of Directors for the last year. So I'd like to give Joe a huge round of congratulations. You now have to speak.
You would think as the president, I would know about things.
There are some things in this world that are surprises, so.
It was leading this agency was very beneficial to me, and I hope to Cleveland Metro Parks. You're so interconnected to people all across the country who come from varying degrees of backgrounds and systems that are part of different communities, and to gain a level of knowledge and lead that group for a period of time was very beneficial to me personally, and I think I brought a lot back to Cleveland Metro Parks. I know I talked to Brian a lot about this agency specifically, and I mentioned it a lot in my travels because it's really unlike NRPA, which is just so massive and incorporates much more. This is a smaller group of high-level park professionals that are really focused on guiding direction and legislation and policies and procedures across the country. Wow. So it was a real joy to lead this agency and to be a part of it for so long. So I'm going to thank somebody. I'm assuming ANACRO for facilitating this. But yeah, thank you very much.
Congrats.
You.
Well done. That's why it was the president.
Excellent.
There is no old business. The next meeting is Thursday, October 14th. A few of us will be traveling to NRPA for the hopeful gold medal ceremony. And we do have a work session, which will start in 10 or so minutes. So we'll reconvene after that. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you say there is no executive session?
we're going to really bring the plan forward for the board's approval. You can unlock us now, I think. What's up? There we go. So here's just a quick, I'm not going to read all of these things, just in an effort of time, we can read through all of them, but here's what we're going to work through for this morning. There are quite a few things, but really it's starting to synthesize itself as we're working forward here. Go ahead, David. I appreciate, I think Sean did this. This is my first time actually using this. I might. Oh, geez.
Simple on off.
I blame Sarah. If you look at this whole chart here, we are in September. The teams have been working all the way through. If we go back all the way into 2020, really bringing this forward. So this is just a lot of words, but the work is being done relative to it. You did see this in the last part of the slide presentation. We want to show how the board is seeing things, how we're bringing it forward, how conservation, recreation, education have been part of the mission for over 104 years. The first annual report is really pretty fascinating as we talk about that. When we talk about the 2012, it seems like a long time ago, but really we were talking about moving it forward to the 2020, the Emerald Necklace Centennial Plan. Wow. We talked about green infrastructure. We talked about the scale, about where we've come from, really driving results in the city of Cleveland and inner ring suburbs, really being more thoughtful about our outdoor recreation. The regional greenway system, that has really come to fruition over the last 10, 11 plus years. And I applaud Cuyahoga County and the leadership that helped create that, because I think we are truly a national leader in our greenway planning. I think there are some, as in Indianapolis and a few others, that have had some, you know, good conversations with their different trails, cultural garden trails, but I would say Cleveland is definitely leading nationally. We've talked about these connections to other park districts. We saw one for the approval of a grant today to connect to Medina. We're picking up land in Richfield Township. The lakefront, people remember the lakefront, was a huge part of what we wanted to drive forward. And I really want to applaud this group of commissioners to move forward with the lakefront sands, you know, in a levy year. And that was a really bold move. The community needed it. They've responded. Financial sustainability, just to highlight that, we do operate on a 10-year levy. We remain debt-free. When we approved our last levy, the key drivers were fiscal responsibility and asset protection. And I think we've done those things along the way. Certainly, we have more to do, more infrastructure, and some of the things, you know, we'll talk about as we go through this next plan. I am going to introduce Leon Younger. Leon was here for a number of years in Lake Metro Parks. He is truly the leader in this field of expertise with demographic, leisure trends, travels. I don't want to get him to have too big of a head, but we do very much appreciate the consistency. I think that's one of the things that we strive for in this plan, was a look back and then looking forward. So I will turn it over to Leon just to give us a few bits of kind of information as we go through this. So Leon, welcome. You're live with the board.
Okay, thanks a lot, Brian. Appreciate it. It was nice to see all the improvements and additions to the park system that came out of the 2012 plan, and certainly was an honor to work with you guys. So I just wanted to share that. Today, we're just really, we had an opportunity to work with the staff on three areas, the demographic and leisure trends, looking at what other providers are providing to the community that are similar to the metro parks, and then looking at kind of benchmarking with national peers. It's hard to find a organization like Cleveland Metro Parks that really matches up because of the strong conservation effort that you have, and that you're managing your zoo. Where a lot of agencies have zoos under their organization, they're actually managed by a conservancy or Zoo Friends or something like that. But needless to say, the information we've gotten provides some real demonstration that the staff has really followed the plan and also has implemented the actions associated with it. So this plan really outlines how the park district can have greater impact by addressing different levels of concern surrounding communities. The whole idea was to really to be the connector as well as the leader in parks and recreation in the Cleveland region.
I think you did an excellent job, Leon. Again, this is a work session, so Kelly's going to come up and we're just going to kind of start walking through the framework. Leon, if you want to add in, there's a couple slides that you may want to just tie in a little bit from where we came from on some of our cost recoveries. And it's not lost on the fact that you did a whole operational analysis of our operations department during the last basically look back to really look at how we were doing things within the confines of what nationally was being accepted. So I do appreciate the help and consistency. Kelly?
Yes, great. Well, I think it is really helpful to look back and to think about, you know, the world when this plan was really initiated back in 2010, just coming through that Great Recession and really spurring a successful organization to think about how it could have greater impact and greater benefit to the community. So this, I love this graphic, you know, it highlights just a lot of amazing accomplishments over the past 10 years. But what we want to do also is break things down into those accomplishments related to the 7 key directions. So green infrastructure, I think everybody defines green infrastructure a little bit differently, but really big picture, it's talking about protecting air, water, habitat, and those associated benefits to people. And so what have we been able to do? We have a strong partnership with the sewer district. It's interesting with the land we've acquired, we've been able to remove 3.6 acres of buildings. So again, reducing impervious surfaces, doing retrofits to reduce stormwater runoff in multiple locations, and then doing some major stream and wetland restoration projects. And you just heard about Foster's Run this morning. So this is really just intended to be a snapshot of some of the accomplishments. Thinking about scale, this seems a little nebulous, but I would term it as just expanding our ability to impact our community. So how do we do that? A lot of it is through partnerships. As folks have touched on, the Cuyahoga Greenways Plan, we have built a coalition with our surrounding metro parks in the surrounding counties that we call the Northeast Ohio Parks Coalition. Again, you saw a presentation about how we're going to connect to Medina County eventually. Creation of new parks. I mean, this is just mind-boggling to stand here and think, you know, in 2010, we didn't have lakefront reservation. We didn't have the lakefront portion of Euclid Creek or Acacia. And then what we've been able to achieve through community partnerships with these municipalities and nonprofits coming, you know, coming together with Dunham Park, Brighton Park, the work with the West Creek Conservancy, Broadview Heights, both the Valley Parkway Connector and Ackerman. And then as Sarah touched on earlier, you know, what's the root of a lot of this? It's to expand access to parks. With that expanded access, a special focus on the EJ communities and Cleveland and the inner ring suburbs. And so part of that we take care of through an expanded outreach program with outdoor experiences, the great work of our outdoor recreation team, again, that urban trail network and adding new facilities. When we took over Rivergate, I think that was not a destination. And through activating it with Merwin's and other investments, that's a great place where people go to recreate now. And again, participating in these planning initiatives so that we can help lay the framework for the great accomplishments of the next 10, 20, 30 years. Again, these have been mentioned already today, but Greenways, Vision for the Valley, Cheers, and then TLCIs throughout our service area. Outdoor Rec is really a fun one. Boy, have you ever been around as many energetic people as Rachel and her staff? Just the work that they're able to do to expand and address those needs that were identified through that past planning effort. We knew there was an increased interest in paddle sports, and boy, that's really exploded through the pandemic and beyond. Looking at accessibility upgrades, we've made ADA improvements throughout the park district that help, you know, that's another way we're getting more people to the parks. Working with partners to get 2 water trails designated over the past few years. Ralph and his team expanding mountain bike trails. We see that demand. There are also beautiful hiking trails. Then archery and backcountry campsites are just 2 other highlights of areas where we've made improvements.
Greenway system. Sarah did a great job highlighting a lot of the trails work, so I won't spend a ton of time on this slide, but I think, you know, we know we've really seen, we've seen improvements, and we've seen the community's response to those, you know, just a lot of affection, a lot of use for those trails. The lakefront, we have those exciting capital improvements that people think of with the beach house, with the pier. We want to highlight too those more invisible improvements that really keep everything running with infrastructure and long-term maintenance issues that have been addressed. And then circulation. There's a tremendous need for the lakefront parks. We see that, you know, busy weekends at Edgewater, and these circulation improvements help address that. And honestly, we're looking to the future too with things like Cheers about how we can address that demand in other places. And then what really makes all this work is the ability to do this in a sustainable manner. The creativity of our overall staff. I love the image of the drive-through zoo. You know, when we really seemed like we had very limited options, staff was able to pivot and identify an opportunity and address, again, a need that the community saw. So along with that, the cost recovery efforts that we'll touch on again later, merging two different marketing departments for efficiency, creating the development department so that there is a team to address, you know, pursuing grants, building these donor relationships, the enterprise division, which has seen great success. And then again, this is, I liken this to kind of the infrastructure, but information technology, the tremendous growth there over the past 10 years to really allow all of us to do our jobs most efficiently and protect the park district. You know, we look at a lot of security issues with ITS. So there, I'll take a break and we'll kind of pivot to the engagement portion. So, you know, that was the past. Here's where we're looking toward the future. We're about kind of just in the early stages of doing some staff engagement, because we want the plan to be more than a document. We want everyone that's part of the team to really realize the impact their day-to-day work has in achieving these overarching goals. Thank you to the board. You know, we're 3/4 of the way through our check-ins with you to get guidance about the direction of the plan. We have online engagement available. Brian is meeting with some stakeholder groups over the coming month. And then we have some public open houses scheduled. At this point, those are likely, you know, we're working to reschedule those so they will be outdoors in the same location, and then holding a couple virtual meetings as well. We've had some fun engagement this summer, and kind of popping up in areas where we don't always have a presence. These events are in North Gordon Park, kind of north of the boat ramp, so that we're in proximity to some neighborhoods and connecting with new groups of people. We're also taking, you know, our materials and going out to other community festivals. We had a great outgoing intern this summer who tabled at a lot of our parks to get feedback from folks. And I did put a copy of the kind of the general comment card on your desk, and then a couple of the stickers that we're passing out just to help energize the process. Just a quick summary of some of the things we've heard. You know, it's funny, sometimes we get huge ideas, you know, like, oh, you should take over Highland Park, or very, you know, very detailed ideas. You know, we want some more benches. So, you know, we're trying to document those and incorporate those into our overall plan. Again, thinking about the past and the key directions, how those were updated in 2015 and kind of grouped into 5 strategic goals. What we're looking at for this current round of planning is to really highlight 6 areas and to make these action oriented. And as you can see, we're in the midst of wordsmithing, trying to get all these key terms accommodated within the goal statements. So I did include just a handout for that. You know, wordsmithing by committee is kind of challenging, but we welcome any input you'd like to offer as we. Yes, that's right. That's right. Yes, yeah, our goal is a very inclusive process. But we think that, you know, by highlighting this kind of honeycomb, you know, that that really gets to the core of what we're working on. And there's a lot of overlap between these areas, but this explains who we are. Then along with that, we're looking to have an updated mission statement. This is from the 2012 plan. And again, I think this was, it was really key to lay out a lot of information with that overall kind of direction and expansion with the 2012 plan. But our thought is, as we look at kind of more current mission statements, these are kind of short and sweet, and they're energizing. We're thinking examples like this could help with our development of a mission statement. And so with this, I'd like to pass it over to Beth and our marketing team. They've done a great job of researching, you know, how we're perceived now and advancing the thought of a mission statement.
Morning. So I'm going to walk us through some of the research that we had looked at over the years. So the first thing I thought of was, why don't we look at some of the external data that we have over the years of asking, what comes to mind when you think of Cleveland Metro Parks? You know, what sort of descriptors, you know, are at the forefront of your thought when you're thinking of Cleveland Metro Parks as far as our community is concerned? So over the past decade, I looked at many different quantitative surveys that we had put out there asking these questions. So on the left here, you can see our word cloud that kind of represents organically what people think of without being prompted anything. So, you know, the bigger the word, the more times it came up. So a lot of these terms, beautiful, relaxing, peaceful, nature. And then on the right hand side, we had given them a list of terms and which ones, you know, if you had to select your top three, which ones are your favorite. So you can see peaceful, family friendly, friendly, protecting nature and wildlife. A lot of these terms kind of interweave, but over the course of looking at the 8 to 10 quantitative studies we've done, these did not change over those 10 years. They've stayed consistent from our community, which was great. So these are terms that are really strong, and these are things that the community is already thinking of when they think of us without us, you know, having to put it out there. So then I also looked at some of the qualitative research that we had done over this past time frame as well. So this is going to be more your in-person focus group setting. And again, when asked that same question, you know, what words would you use to describe Cleveland Metro Parks? A lot of the same terminology came up: inspiring, beautiful, relaxing, fun. So a lot of these terms that we are taking into consideration as we think of, you know, evolving the mission statement over time. So looking at this external feedback and also taking into consideration some of the internal feedback. So we hosted a couple internal focus group sessions with employees to kind of get a feel for, you know, what are your expectations from a mission statement? You know, where do we go from 2012 to now? And a lot of the big takeaways that we heard internally were keeping the statement short and memorable. And I think, you know, a lot of us internally agreed with that as well, and employees really got on board. And then wanting the statement to be active and dynamic, not necessarily just passive or generic. And these words on the right represented the words that resonated most with employees. And there's a lot of overlap with external and internal, which is great. So inspiring, communities, protecting. Equality ends up being sort of that platform for all of these that interweaves into all of the other words that are up there. So a lot of these are just extremely important terms that we came up internally.
Beth, it's something like trails in the woods. I see you're trying not to be specific about anything, but don't we have to be a little bit specific in this area?
I'll tie into that. Yeah. I think the answer is no-ish. I think it's this very unique balance of not singling out one. I mean, we have 19 million recreation visits, a world-class zoo, 5 nature centers, 8 golf courses, marinas, waterfronts, and everything. And trails, you know, is one of the components, obviously, but it's not the highest. And so when you look at how this word pyramid kind of got put together, it was really pulled from the breadth of what we do. So you'll see embedded into some of the other statements of where these other things kind of pull into it. So I don't know that highlighting that one is specifically appropriate when we're looking at this part of the visioning of it. It's, I know it's your passion, so I'm very careful as to what you believe.
No. I understand what you're saying. I think that a lot of times what we think about you know, we're trying to think broadly, but I think we're also offering a product, and I think the product is, you know, it's like Ford Motor describing their car. They can describe it relative to other things, which, you know, we don't really have to do that. And they can also describe it by features. But they can also say it's beautiful, it's exhilarating, but you wouldn't buy a Ford necessarily because of that. But I follow what you're saying, but it's very general. And you gave them choices, right, in the first set.
The first slide for external, the first word cloud, which I can go back, was just organically, these are the terms they came up with.
But were they given a list?
For the first portion, no.
Yeah.
These were terms that they just came up with on their own. Okay. Being asked the question, what words would you use to describe Cleveland Metro Parks? These are the terms they came up with without giving any guidance.
And they were very, very similar to the previous 10 years. So if you go 10 years back, these have all kind of been very consistent.
You would think they would have said beaches or something like that, but no.
I think it's in beautiful, it's in nature, it's relaxing, it's in peaceful. I think all of those things.
It's more
kind of across.
Yeah. Yeah, I follow. Continue. I didn't mean to interrupt.
So looking at the external findings and the internal findings, we kind of, you know, took a stab at maybe morphing into what could a potential mission statement look like after reviewing the data over the 10 years externally and then what we heard internally. And this was something that had come up based off of that feedback. And I think while this might not be finalized, I think this is, you know, the direction that maybe we are looking to go, coming to something short and sweet and those more, I guess, larger terms that some of the subsets under the Cleveland Metro Parks umbrella can fall into these different categories in this.
So now I'm going to be Dan Moore. So communities to me is just a very monolithic word. It's intended because community can be very, but like neighborhoods or people, I mean, is there any discussion about?
It could be connecting people, communities, and inspiring conservation. And this is a kick at it, because when you look to wordsmith something, it can
place differently for everyone.
But I like the suggestion of people, for sure.
But for example, if you had the top three reasons that we have a vision for the Metro Park, I don't think it would be inspiring conservation in our world. It would be more local.
And see, the challenge we have with that, Dan, is that we run a zoo that does global conservation abroad. So it's incorporating that narrative of what we actually do. If you look at all of the levels of conservation, that's why the world was actually put in there, because we do have an impact. Debbie and I were in Spain a number of years ago, and we talked about the climate impact, and we talked about what we're doing. We talk about carbon sequestration, and all of that does actually matter for the world, not just the local.
I understand, but if you looked at our budget and you looked at what we actually do, in other words, what is it that we do and what is it people are expecting of us, they're not worrying about the orangutans in Uganda.
Sort of the trick of it is that if you focus on your locale and everyone does it, repeats it all around, that multiplier effect.
Yeah, it's good, but
it's being conscious of we're in a global community, so we do our part. I mean, we hear that message a lot.
But I look at it as conservation of everything. I mean, green space, and we're a leader across the world in doing what we do across the board.
Yeah.
I kind of like it being that big, because I think, you know, these statements are supposed to be visionary.
Ambitious.
They're supposed to be, right, exactly, the next step. And I think that's kind of cool.
I think it's cool, but I don't think it's necessarily honest. I mean, because I...
If you keep saying it, then everybody will believe it.
Well, that's
plenty of proof of that.
That comes directly from Trump.
we'll keep moving, and we'll bring this back again. But I think there's
a vision.
Yes.
Just to argue a little bit with you though, Bruce, on the word. I like the word community, because to me that means it does mean people and physical place. Whereas people is just people. Whereas community to me could mean, you know, different neighborhoods. And but it's
bigger
than both. You know, it's both. And so I think again, it's a broader word.
Yeah, community is nice as well.
Used word. That's some nice alliteration there.
Sure.
Yeah, I understand.
We'll move on. But these are always one of the most challenging things, but I have to give, I have to give marketing, Jeff Tolman, they took so much of the history of the words and what's actually brought people together and then synthesize that together. So we think that's a pretty solid start.
Yep.
Pass it back off to Kelly. Thank you.
Great. Well, I'll kind of, I'll be the on the ground person and look to Leon to offer some commentary, but we'd like to get into then kind of some of the nuts and bolts of the benchmarking study that we commissioned from PROS Consulting. So again, this is a document that's required by CAPRA, and we went out to find peers across the country. So Leon, if you'd like to describe kind of the peer selection, I want to open up the floor to you to speak as much as you'd like.
Okay, thank you. Basically, we had in the last planning effort in 2012, we had 5 other agencies, but we ended up using Miami-Dade County Parks and Fairfax County again, mainly because they were willing to support it. And then secondly is to share their information with us. We incorporated Dallas. It's a city-county combined system. It operates like a Metro Parks because of the way it's set up. And then also Maryland National Capital is a park district similar to the Metro Parks. So, and then we included, because these are all gold medal agencies, we included BRAC from Louisiana, mainly because they operate their zoo. And we wanted to incorporate an agency that did have a zoo within their system, even though it's the population size is smaller. We they have a really strong national reputation, so that's why those were included. Just in terms of benchmarking, you can see whether they're a county, a city, a park district, or authority. A lot of the park districts and authorities operate somewhere. In terms of population, Dallas, Cleveland, Fairfax County, similar population. And then just your jurisdiction size, you can kind of see where those fall out. And the population per square miles, winners of national gold medal, and everyone's accredited. Okay. When we talk about looking at full times equivalent, you can really see per 10,000 residents where the other agencies are versus where Cleveland Metro Parks is. And that's a really, really good number in relationship to being conservative in terms of staffing levels per 10,000 people. Obviously that's when you look at, as we go on here, you'll see that your total staffing costs is about 55% of your total budget. Normally when it gets above 60%, people really start having real issues with being able to cover all of their costs associated because they have more costs with people, but this is a good number from PROS perspective.
Sorry about that.
I lost the screen.
This is the part where you ad lib and fill space.
that was your on the ground assistant. The wrong button. Okay.
All right. And then looking at acreage, you can see where Maryland National Capital Planning and Fairfax County and Cleveland and also Dallas, I mean, relatively all close in acres per 1,000 residents. And certainly, because you're a conservation agency, you don't really focus on city parks or community parks. They're all regional parks or reservations. And so, I think the national average, when you look at it, 10 acres per 1,000, you can really see how much stronger you are. And it's always been Cleveland Metro Park's strength is its demonstration being a regional park system in your city, your area.
Can I ask a question about that one? So some of those park districts at the top there, and even the Dallas one, have a huge number of parks, but similar acres. Does that mean they have a bunch of very tiny little parks?
Yeah, they're a city-county combined system. And so, yeah, they have a lot more smaller. They do have regional parks, but it's hard to find a regional park system like Cleveland Metro Parks that has the same level of population and the amount of acreage. A lot of park districts, let's just use Summit County as an example, have doesn't have the population, doesn't have the acres. It's hard to get to an apples to apples. So, but because they both are city, they offer neighborhood, community, and regional parks, but the total acres, that's kind of how we looked at it. I mean, we could, you know, that's just how we positioned it.
It just does seem like a little bit of a different management than
yes,
distribution.
It's so hard. Milwaukee County was 15,000 acres and 156 parks. Some of them were regionally significant in the 2,000 acres, and some of them were an acre. And so it's Chicago Park District is, you know, a billion plus dollar budget, but they've got Soldier Field and other things tied to it. East Bay out in San Francisco, you know, the Bay Area, I think they're in like the 48 to 70,000 some acres, but they're encompassing the municipal utility districts that are tied to it. So it's very hard to synthesize this. And I think the team did as best they could based on what's kind of readily available for the benchmark. And you kind of have to pull out the stuff that's really useful. And some of the stuff, it's just hard to put a comparison together. It's just very hard.
I imagine we've assembled acreage. It's different than.
Correct.
Isn't there another issue where, like take Fairfax County Park Authority, don't they handle a lot of the school athletic programs?
Correct, Dan, and as well as Maryland National Capital, when you look at their total number of parks and you look at, you know, their employee, they are, you know, in the programming end of things, summer lunches and everything else, and that's not something we do. So again, it's sometimes you have to pull and extrapolate out and synthesize the stuff that's valuable. Mm-hmm. Good catch.
Okay, and I know that trails are very important to your residents and to the metro parks. You can kind of see the miles of trail that you all have in relationship to these larger communities and paved trails, all very close in terms of total trail miles. You're at 0.25. The best practices in the United States is at 0.4, but you know, for such a large system, you know, that's a good number. I mean, it demonstrates that you're living up to what people are looking for and the priority of connectivity, which is what you're doing right now, which is great. In terms of total expenditures, you can see where the total expenditures fall out for personnel. I mentioned that 55%, other agencies are right around 50. And then Fairfax County is right at 59. Again, operational, you can see where what your total operational cost to manage the system, and then capital, where the strength of the metro parks is, as Brian had mentioned, you know, your ability to get your levies passed every 10 years and the reinvestment in capital, the way you set yourselves up, where everybody else has to go through a different framework for getting capital. And so that really helps to keep your facilities really relevant and helps to support the kind of infrastructure you have under your control. And I think that's a great perspective in this particular slide. And then just non-tax revenues, again, where you guys have picked up in your grants and certainly in your user fees for associated with delivering services, and really all of the kind of miscellaneous revenue that you have, very, very strong. It's been a really incredible, because when we did the last plan we were looking at that time, you were about 17% cost recovery. And we were, one of the recommendations was to try to get to 30%, which was a 1% increase, which would have, you know, that still the national standards right now for all park systems is 37%, so you're greater than that. And then looking at the cost recovery levels and cost per resident, you can see where Maryland National Capital is, BREC is, Cleveland Metro Parks, and you're looking at Miami-Dade, you know, really relatively in that per capita per resident, and then also looking at the population and non-tax revenue where you're at 44-45% now. So that's, I mean, really, really strong, really strong.
Go ahead.
As mentioned,
can we go back to that slide?
Yep. Hang on 1 second, Leon.
I just want to point out that where it shows the NRPA median, that's specifying operating expense only per resident for that 54-68. We are showing total expenditures. The two slides prior did the breakdown for us on capital versus operating. We had about 23 million of that 125 million was capital related. So we've got that all baked in if you're doing a comparative purpose for that metric with NRPA.
Good catch. And Dan, we'll get you the slides. Very good.
I do think it's complicated to do benchmarking here. And I think it's for budgeting and that sort of thing, I think it's better to look at, do the bottoms up approach where you look at what we are doing. You know, we don't have athletic posts. Yeah, you do both, but this is, you can be led astray by this because you.
I'm not disputing it, but I think by doing it, it allows you to point out differing characteristics. And then I think to your point, you dig in deeper as to what the value, what are the values that we deliver that are not delivered, vice versa. So I think you still need to do comparison.
But they're so dramatically different. I mean, for example, when you have a whole school athletic program tied to the park system, I mean, that just skews everything. So
I think you can dissociate that.
You know, right.
And then the part of it is it opened up, I think, in theory anyway, is this something we should or shouldn't get into? What are the pitfalls of doing it?
Yeah.
Because a lot of times people will say, you're not doing this or you're not doing this. It's because it's a chance to do that. But I don't disagree. I mean, it's very, very hard to compare us apples to apples across the board.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much different than a business. Where if you're making parts for automobiles, you can compare things, but boy, this is tricky.
It is, and I think that's we have to know ourselves, and we have to know what we're good at and what we're trying to do. Where I think it was very helpful from when I came in and this leadership, you know, the board came in, was really looking at the opportunity cost of what now some of the cost recovery models have given us. They've given us the ability to be successful in different areas, to reinvest in the golf courses instead of a 70% subsidy.
And let me interrupt that because I think that's a message. I mean, we hear from Marty all the time, you know, why are we charging people stuff? Why are we doing all of these, you know, between drinking and partying and all the, you know, you can look at the dim side of it, but that's part of cost recovery. You know, it's a way of generating revenue. How we apply those revenues elsewhere. Isn't that where you're going with?
Absolutely. And it's an evolution. And I think it's, you know, the focus is, if you really look at it, how we've conserved land. I mean, that's one of the true successes, 24,000 acres from the original three. The evolution of the park district, of where we've come from and how we've had to do things. A global pandemic has definitely changed a number of factors in how people use the parks, where they're using the parks, record numbers. But looking at how do we continue to make hand and glove decisions to get us there, to meet the ends, being fiscally responsible, we have not borrowed money, how we've paid for things as we've gone, how we've expanded the park district, including more offerings and more access. So I think all of those things do tie together.
I would think one interesting set of values would be the extent to which we have really conserved habitat, water quality, air quality, how well we play that game compared to others. You know, this goes back to the statement about, you know, global,
our impact,
in the world, you know, what are we doing? Well, I would think, I would like to think, we have such a mix of properties that we assemble and how we go about doing that. There's a science to that and an accomplishment that I think people really, we should be able to quantify that.
And I'd be further curious about those benchmarks. Are they still acquiring property? I mean, some of those districts that are city, right, probably
all
aren't.
Out. Mm-hmm.
So again, there's no additional
qualitative
value add of continuing to grow a system. It just is static. And
In my time in Milwaukee, there was no additional acquisition, very few, maybe median transfers and others. And I think of the global, you know, the thing, when you look at the area of concern, it's a great example, the Cuyahoga River, the amount of work in the last 10 years that's been done, please know that's, you know, very intentional, and it affects the water quality, affects the Great Lakes, it affects, it's an ecosystem that's tied together.
From a pest management practices, in other words, what landscape architecture is all about. LED, all of those components, basically that's in our wheelhouse. And so when we're connecting neighborhoods, or when we look at a place like the city of Euclid now taking on these erosion issues and the utilities having to protect their assets, and on top of that, you end up with something that people will enjoy in a park-like setting. I mean, that integration of planning and execution, I think that's a story that we have been telling and conveying very well. It's like the guidebook for the area. And the more we do that and succeed, the more others try to participate. And measuring that, I think, is important.
And I think I agree with that completely. And I think metrics like how far communities are by bike and by Sarah's point, I think that's extremely important. And you can't really measure some of these because they're different. It's a whole different deal. The geography is different. So I think the important thing is to put down in the back of our minds some very specific missions that have to do with you know, buying how much we of our budget we spend on the amount of money we contribute to buy properties, how we deal with inner city kids, there's a whole series of things that are specific to us, and then measure it on that. I think one is this connectivity thing is extremely important. I mean, you go to, you know, just from the experience I've had biking around the country, you might have a bike ride that's 10 miles long, and they consider it the best thing they've ever seen. And you know, we're just on a different scale. I mean, you look at it, there was a great article about Atlanta, what wonderful things they're doing with their parks. And it was appalling. I mean, it was absolutely terrible what they were doing with their parks. They were doing nothing, you know, compared to what we're doing. So I think, you know, when you have something that doesn't measure well, you know, in a company, it's great because you can measure capital to asset rate, you measure all sorts of ratios and things. But when you're not on the pricing system, you know, when you're measuring intangibles, you've got to define what those intangibles are.
We've been doing that.
Yeah,
we've done it 2 times over.
Yeah.
Not disputing they do more of it, but I think it's cutting short. There's been a real concerted effort, and I think success in messaging the deliverables,
yes,
the metro parks,
yeah,
in terms of how it affects the bottom line of the economy. And to me, as a public official managing a budget, you know, as cities are doing all over the place, you know, villages and communities, to be able to talk to your constituency and say, you know, this park doesn't just look nice and fluffy, it's doing this and it's doing that, and it affects our bottom line.
Yeah.
And it improves, it reduces overhead in certain asset management areas, infrastructure. I mean, I think over time, and that's what I mean by the best management practices, there are ways that we can show that our approach, our methodology to handling the hardscape, the greenscape, whatever you want to call it, overall infrastructure management translates into a lot of benefits that I think people never really appreciated
before. Yeah, and calling it to their attention is good, and measuring it.
And I think we can measure it. It may be more incremental and over time, but that what you yield ultimately in those benefits is, I think, hugely important for us to continue messaging.
Yeah.
I think the other thing too is to add, there are so many aspects of this park district that are free, mm-hmm, free. And mm-hmm, that's one of the things that should not be lost. There's not necessarily a measurement for that. And we are a service, and we do provide the escape. If you look at William Sinscombe's original statements about, you know, being outdoors and being connected to nature, we do all of those things. And they don't necessarily need to be measured or quantified. So there are certain things that we're able to do very well. There are certain things that are part of our mission that will just always kind of be part of it. So I think it's this very unique balance for sure. So having said that, board work session number 4 coming in November, draft plan submitted by the end of the year, final adoption first part of next year, CAPRA documentation in preparation for our 2023. We'll get you the slides. You do have comment cards if you'd like to fill those out as well. But we do appreciate all of the help kind of formulating this forward. We look forward to getting the feedback from the community leaders breakfast that we'll bring back in November.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great presentation.
Yes, never did that.
And well, we're going to do it now because we had that in open session. Yeah. Is there a motion to adjourn the meeting?
So moved.
Second?
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Very good.
It was a challenge.